They got issues. I think this job.
Give me a call. Let's talk.
I got
another committee.
Yeah. Vote on the park and pull my axe on.
Are you not taking effort? Okay.
Get my bag.
The Education Committee will come to order. I am gaveling to usually we get some members shaken out from behind the pillars.
No, I'm on the other side.
We have to be completed here today by 4:30, and so we'd like to finish the agenda and not have to extend our day. I will be having to leave partway in here to present a bill that came from here, which is at Before Higher Ed today. So we need Senator Nelson here too shortly. But I think we could begin. I thought I saw Senator Vanderveer here and present Senate File 2038. Welcome, Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Vanderveer, if you want to begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2038 is intended to give more options to homeschool students with regard to access, if a charter school so decides, to the charter school's programs. So here to testify about the need for the bill is James DeCara, band director at St. Croix Preparatory Academy.
Okay. Eric Kahn?
James DeCaro.
Oh, James DeCaro with the St. Croix Preparatory Academy. Welcome.
At the beginning of this academic year, I had heard from a couple of homeschool families that their kids were interested in taking instrumental music classes. And I thought I saw a unique opportunity to provide both a service to those students and families and a benefit to the charter school that I work for. However, when I inquired with my administration and our sponsoring organization, they informed me that state law currently prevents homeschooled students from taking part in educational activities at school. I see an opportunity that would benefit both these homeschooled students and students within our charter school in three areas. First, as an instrumental music teacher, this would be enormously beneficial for the students that are in my current program. Students in my band classes within my charter school would be able to play in a larger, more complete ensemble, and homeschooled students would have the opportunity to play in a music ensemble that they otherwise do not have access to. A more complete instrumentation in a larger group means that we can play a wider variety of music, and it's what's expected in a lot of modern music. The second reason I think this is a good fit is that a charter school, much like a public school district in a rural area, tends to have a smaller student body. Traditional public schools that have a typically larger student body in an urban area have a much easier time making up a complete instrumental music ensemble. But a charter school tends to have a little bit more trouble coming up with complete instrumentation. Having homeschooled students with the opportunity to participate in a charter school's ensembles seems like a natural fit. Third, music ensembles do not place the same drain on a school's resources or on a teacher's resources when class sizes are increased. If you add students to a math or English class, for instance, the teacher's correcting load goes up significantly. The materials that are required for the class increase, or more sections are needed. In a musical ensemble, the opposite effect occurs. The larger the ensemble, up to a point, provides a richer experience for all students involved. Class tends to run much the same way, with the addition of some students, since instruments are typically provided by the family, and music sets that are purchased for a music ensemble come with enough parts for larger groups. So few additional materials are needed. Thank you for taking the time to hear this.
Thank you very much, Mr. DeCaro. Senator Vandiver, you have an amendment, an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. Senator Nelson, are you taking off? Or
I can make that amendment. I would like to move the, is it the A2,
the
Madam A2 Chair?
The A2 amendment is author's amendment. This is the first hearing the bill has heard, and so that will put the bill in the shape that he wants to consider it. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. So the amendment is adopted. And your introduction, I think, was essentially describing the bill as it was amended, or the original?
Madam Chair, it would be as amended.
As amended. So now we have it in that form. Are there questions that you have of Mr. DeCaro? Are there questions you have relative to the bill? I think, as you understand, this is shared time. Is the music considered a curricular or co-curricular part of your program at the charter school?
Curricular.
Okay. So that is sometimes the co-curricular. Homeschoolers are an extracurricular. They're able to participate by statute. That was something put in place some years ago. But this, in this case, it would allow shared time between any of the non-public or homeschool with the regular school on the same basis as it is between public school. Charter schools to be participating as a public school along with the regular district schools on the same basis. Any further discussion on this bill, or have you had a chance to digest it, or are you ready to vote?
Madam Chair?
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Vandiver, or if the department, I'm curious if the Department of Education has an opinion, position on this.
Senator Wigger, I have not heard from them on the bill. It's been out there a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does not represent a major change, but Mr. McHenry, would you like to say something? You're welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, the Department of Education. Just looking through the amendment, I did have some prepared comments that I could go through. I was looking to see how the bill had changed with the amendment, so I'm going to apologize in advance if I'm covering things that the author had made some changes to. But from when we put together this bill, as introduced, may prevent a school board from uniformly applying a shared time policy to residents of the districts. The board's policy may limit the number of times or classes that would be available on a shared time basis at the public school district, but the policy could not apply to homeschool students taking shared time classes at a charter school. The bill could be in violation of federal guidelines that require the public school district in which a non-public student is enrolled to provide special education services. Charter schools cannot have resident students because they do not have boundaries. However, if the interpretation is that the charter school can generate the shared time aid directly as if it were a resident district, should there be a bill back to the resident district if the student has an IEP and has received special education instruction? It is unclear who would be responsible for transporting homeschool students to the charter school. Under a tuition agreement, the resident district might be responsible, or would the charter school assume the responsibility since this is not a tuition agreement? Current statute already allows charter schools to generate shared time aid with the resident district's permission. The department is unaware of any charter schools being denied shared time aid because a resident district refuses to either allow the charter school to collect the shared time aid or pay the charter school the cost of the shared time instruction. I apologize of comparing this with the amendment. Obviously, we'd like to, we can spend some time with the author as if this bill is moving forward with some concerns. And
Senator Vandiver, do you have any response?
Chair, I believe some of that. Maybe Mr. Nauman could talk about it. The amendment, I thought, dealt with a couple of those issues that were brought up.
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair and members, I think one of the ways to maybe to think about this is the department, I asked Dr. Melcher, I worked with him a little bit on this, to clarify the department's position on homeschool students attending a charter school. We all know that charter schools are public schools, and so the statute certainly and the department's interpretation of the statute certainly permits, under current law, a shared time student to attend a charter school, and the dollars for shared time aid would indeed flow. We can provide for the committee Dr. Melcher's interpretations of those statutes. So what I'm leading up to is that at worst, this is a clarification of the department's existing statutes. And I think that beyond that, I'll leave it to your discretion of what you want to do next.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nauman. So you don't see it in with Mr. Melcher's blessing, he's seeing that interpretation. Mr. Melcher, do you want to affirm or add any further clarification on that?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I've just seen the amendment here. In my conversations with Mr. Nauman, we confirmed that we do currently consider a charter school to be eligible to provide shared time services and for shared time aid to be generated based on those pupil units. The original bill language, as I understand it, would have made the provision of the shared time services a mandatory thing rather than an optional thing, and it appears that the amendment is maybe making it a little bit more optional. I'm kind of just reading through this as I, if the resident district agrees.
Madam Chair and members,
Mr. Nauman,
I might be able to assist. In Section 2 of the bill is the exception language, and in the under current law, a resident district essentially has to agree for the purposes of billing shared time aid. And if there's an agreement, students may attend a public school where the student doesn't live. Essentially, a non-resident can attend a district or a charter school that is where they don't live. And under the language of Section 2, there's basically a couple things happening. The first part is to add charter school where it says a district. And in my view, and in relative to the memo that Dr. Melcher wrote to me, that piece is a clarification, and maybe Dr. Melcher would like to comment about that. But what the language in Section 2 also does is say that the resident district must grant the authority for a non-resident or for a student to attend a non-resident public school, and that the dollars would flow.
Which would be something like open enrollment. We've got existing policy that's very consistent with what's being requested here.
Then, Madam Chair, on lines 2.26 and through the balance of the section, there continues to be an agreement relationship that relates to the billing of any unreimbursed education costs. And that, although the language is reworked slightly, it is left to the resident district and the district of attendance to work out an agreement for the billing of any unreimbursed costs. But the first part of the subdivision changes the relationship so that a resident district must grant permission.
That's your understanding, too.
So essentially the
Mr. Melcher, or Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
That's
right. The amendment would not be making any dramatic change from current law. It's clarifying the provision on page one that was consistent with our interpretation at any rate. And so the primary change is that it requires the resident district to allow the charter school or the non-resident district to claim the aid, which is taking one step out of the process, kind of streamlining the process, which could result in a small increase in the number of students that are being served because you've kind of made the process a little bit easier for all of the people involved.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
To that point, the department assumed, and I apologize, I didn't make copies, Senator Vandiver's original bill carried a 14 and 15 cost of $21,000 each year. It goes up to 42, I believe. Madam Chair, correction, 40 and 41 in fiscal years 14 and 15, but there's no cost in the current biennium.
Okay. All right. Any further questions of our witnesses or folks at the table? I'm advised here that the effective date probably should be for Section 2. But wouldn't this start to generate the revenue? Wouldn't there be a cost? Would that get rid of the fiscal?
Madam?
This is the way they're doing it.
Okay. But it's additional kids coming into it. Okay. In Section 2? Okay. So could we have a motion to move that exception or that effective date to apply to Section 2 instead of Section 1?
Yeah.
Eric? Is that...
Madam Chair, I think it's... If I'm wrong, finance will correct me on this, but I'm not sure it is of material difference. If you want to be careful, it probably makes sense to do it. If you're worried about a cost, the fiscal note did not assume a cost associated with Section 2 in the current biennium. That cost is lagged, but it doesn't hurt to be careful.
So the section, well, either move it or move it later so that it applies to the whole thing.
Madam Chair, I'd just make the entire bill effective for section, repeat the effective date, I think, is safest.
Okay. So can you, would somebody move that? Senator Stump, you'd like to move that? All right, thank you.
I'd move that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So Senator Stump moves that the effective date apply to both sections be included with both sections.
Madam Chair, I apologize.
We have some staff disagreement going on here as to whether it should apply to Section 1 at all.
Madam Chair, I think if it's the pleasure to repeat what they're already doing, simply move the effective date from Section 1 to Section 2, and I think it probably is fine.
Okay. And Dr. Melcher is concurring with
Madam
that?
Madam Chair, I would concur with that, since Section 1 is simply a clarification of what the department's current interpretation is.
Sure.
Wouldn't be
okay. So Senator Stumpf's amendment moves the effective date to apply to Section 2 and not to Section 1. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Is there any further discussion on the bill? If not, we'll
Let's see, who moved that original? Did anybody move? Yeah, Senator Stumpf moves that Senate file 2038 be recommended to pass.
As amended.
And it will need to go to the Finance Committee. Okay. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Vanderveer, Mr. DeCaro.
Thank you.
So the next bill is Senator Thompson's, Senate File 2183.
That's it. Oh.
So this is your stuff. This is not. Senator Thompson, and welcome, Senator Superintendent Peterson from Minnetonka School District, a district that both Senator Bonhoff and I represent.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Thompson, are you trying to make special inroads? Yes. Excuse me, Senator.
I just wanted to note for the record that I also represent.
Yes, Senator Hand. I'm flanked by them. So the Minnetonka School District has this committee loaded.
They don't get any special consideration.
No. Senator Thompson.
All right. Madam Chair, I have no conflict of interest here. I do not represent any of Minnetonka, so let's be clear about that. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing me to come today and talk to you about Senate File 2183. And I'm going to be very brief because the two gentlemen that are here with me will do a better job of describing the problem that we're attempting to address here than I can do because they live with it on a daily basis. The short version of this, Madam Chair and members, is that the commissioner will frequently be asked to make determinations on certain issues that may be going on within a particular school or a particular school district. And in addressing those things, the department seems to have more or less at times made their responses in such a way that they are attempting to cause them to have the force of law. And it goes beyond, as we all know, if we remember our Schoolhouse Rock, right? The legislature passes the bills, and the governor at the state level signs the bills into law, and it is then up to the executive to administer the laws, but not make the laws. And what it appears to be, Madam Chair and members, is that the commissioner is more or less attempting to make decisions and enforce behavior on school districts and rules that, in fact, have not gone through the administrative process, have not gone through the rulemaking process, have not been brought back to the legislature. So that line is being crossed where, rather than interpreting the law, it seems to be there is a bit of making the law. And so as members take a look at this relatively short bill, we attempt to address that by making it clear what the commissioner can and cannot do, and also giving a little bit of a remedy, for lack of a better term, to school districts. But with that, I do think the gentleman I have here with me will do a better job than I can of describing the problem. So I don't know which of you prefers to go first, but why don't we start with Mr. Lundell, if you want to address the committee.
Welcome, Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brad Lundell. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. This bill was first introduced 4 years ago, and we discussed it then. I work with the special education community, and there's many times when, whether it's a compliance visit, compliance and monitoring visit, that decisions will be made. There are times when laws are interpreted in such a way that, as Senator Thompson says, really go beyond what we believe the department's authority is. And as this law clearly points out, that when it comes in the form of a bulletin, memorandum, complaint decision, we're saying that that should not have the force of law. There is a provision in here for the for a district to take it to the administrative law judge if in the instance when something is found that a district wants to dispute. But we think it goes further than that. I think that, as Senator Thompson has said, there's a transparency argument at play here that we believe is very, very important. Special education is very highly regulated by both the state and federal law. And the states oftentimes is in an uncomfortable position when it comes to the interpretation of federal law. But in many of those instances, rather than interpret and do it through memo, we believe that the department should either ask for rulemaking authority or come back to the legislature and ask for a clarification of previously passed legislation. We see this done, I think, fairly often, and I think that in the legislature, and don't throw anything at me, but the legislature needs to do its part and pass clear and concise laws that really kind of narrow the ability of the department or the implementing body to say where we can go. I think that's the
Mr. O'Donnell, you're suggesting that we aren't perfect.
Everyone else but you, Madam
Chair. Right? Not so.
It's not you.
I appreciate your candor. So, and it's very it's very true that we don't do things perfect, because if we did it right the first time, we wouldn't have to come back.
Right. But I think one of the things that we're trying to do with this, and I think it's a transparency. We believe that more discussion is good, more understanding is good, and having that dialogue, and rather than kind of having the department out there saying, we don't think this is important enough to come back. Well, it's very important in some instances because these kinds of memoranda and the like do not have cost impacts associated with them. When you do rules or do laws, you have to do a fiscal note. These memoranda do not have fiscal notes, and we don't know what the cost will be to districts, and in many cases there are costs to districts. 4 years ago when this bill was heard in the House, then Commissioner Al Segrin said, the proponents of this legislation are trying to kill a mouse with a machine gun, because I think that, you know, it was overkill, that the department isn't doing things that go that far off center on this. It's not a matter of mice, machine guns, or personalities in here. This is about process. This is about making things clear. This is about a dialogue between State Department, legislature, executive and legislative branches to make sure that laws and rules are done in such a way that everyone kind of knows what's happening. I mean, we have examples. I think the one that jumps out is an extracurricular example of a few years ago where Centennial went all the way to the state Supreme Court with that and lost, but the department made that ruling, and their ruling was upheld. But it would have been nice to have them come back to the legislature instead of making that ruling unilaterally to say, we've got this problem with participation in extracurricular activities. How does the legislature feel about that, or how does the legislature want to view that in conjunction with federal law? Again, the department's in a difficult position at times because they have to, you know, federal law trumps in many of these areas, or in all areas in special ed. But we add on to those federal laws in many cases. But when we do add on, we think that that has to come through this body and have a dialogue between this body, and that we don't believe happens nearly enough.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Any questions of Mr. Lundell? Not Superintendent Peterson. Dr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. I'm not necessarily speaking on behalf of other districts, although certainly the information I'm providing you has been gathered from more than just the Minnetonka School District. We have concerns that MDE creates an environment whereby their decisions are rules without adhering to the rulemaking process. This is particularly true in the special ed area. As you know, there are many federal and state laws and rules in both the federal and state arenas, and we don't need another set of categories of directives to for our staffs to deal with. This process happens in a couple ways, through the complaint process and through the monitoring process. Through the complaint process, families can file a complaint with MDE if they feel their due process rights are not being followed. The complaint is reviewed by MDE, and then they hand down a decision to the district. MDE also decides the consequences of their findings. It is felt by many that those decisions are not aligned with laws or rules, but often exceed them. It has been common discussion that the outcome is determined by who reviews the complaint rather than the rule of law. Added to this is that the outcome is then used as a precedent in subsequent decisions that the department makes. So it's really a non-rule followed by other non-rule decisions because of that foundation. In the monitoring area, as you know, every 5 years, districts undergo a comprehensive audit of their special education programs. The special ed directors have voiced significant concern that after this last round of audits, that the findings and then corrective actions were well above and beyond the stated federal and state rules. MDE then tried to promulgate rules that students no longer having eligibility for the for being disabled could continue to receive special education services if there was a continued need. And as the case can be made that students need more, the proposed rule would have made it difficult to ever dismiss anyone from special education. Via the monitoring process, MDE continues to raise the bar on the specificity standards for special education paperwork, and I have several examples of that. I'll spare you those examples. When asked what law or rule was changed, they reference their own decision or complaint process decisions. And finally, with the medical assistance billing, the law or rule was that school districts needed to have a system for collecting medical assistance funds for medical services. Districts have relied on the collection from intermediates or cooperatives for many years, collecting on all of our students. MDE has subsequently ruled that intermediates can no longer collect and report on an independent district. Those are just some of the examples of difficulties that our schools are encountering outside of the past laws and made rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. Are there questions? Any questions? Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, Dr. Peterson, do you know why they said that about the intermediates? And also just so people who aren't as familiar with the intermediates explain how the independent school districts actually pay a fee to the intermediates as part of that arrangement.
Right. Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Senator Bonoff, the school district relationship to the intermediates, for example, we belong to the intermediate 287. There are 12 other members of that intermediate at this point, and we not only pay fees, but we also their taxes are collected over our right. tax base that go to 287. So there's a strong relationship, and I don't think is any reason for many of these handed down rules, because they're developed by the department and not based in any written rules. So I can't cite a specific reason why they wouldn't let intermediates do it any longer.
Well, it's kind of interesting because it's kind of counter to the purpose of the intermediates. The intermediates had a broader purpose because they did also function with and operating an area vocational technical school, which are now part of Minsku's system. But it was a means by which the districts could offer things, whether it was courses or other services, do them in a combined fashion. The shared service idea that Senator Bonoff has been working on has been functioning very well. Yep. With a wide range of those kinds of choices. And the idea that you somehow couldn't have them collect data on a particular area and file that report would seem to be counter to what the intent and the role that, that they could play, with, you know, as a part of as being a intermediate district. So, okay, thank you. Thank you for that insight, because I did not know that that was one of the rulings. Are there any other questions that you have? If not, would you like to move your bill?
I don't know, Madam Chair. Anyone else wants to testify?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there any more testimony? My apologies.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify up to this bill. As Mr. Lundell notified before, the previous administration referred to a previous iteration of this bill as killing a mouse with a machine gun. I would have said something more like shrew with a shotgun, but I digress. MD opposes this bill for three main reasons. First, it's redundant, yet it's incomplete. Second, it strips away executive authority that is granted under the Constitution. And it adds confusion because it conflicts with an already existing policy or an agency process that's already in place. Lines 120 to 123 of the bill are duplicative of Minnesota Statute 14.381. However, the bill omits the section of that statute that states, quote, an agency determination is not considered an unadopted rule when the agency enforces a law or rule by applying the law or rule to specific facts on a case-by-case basis. Any person may petition the Office of Administrative Hearings if an agency enforces a pronouncement as though it were a duly adopted rule. An OAH administrative law judge then has statutory authority to determine whether a pronouncement is being enforced as an unadopted rule. The proposed bill is unnecessary because a remedy already exists in law. Secondly, the proposed bill interferes with one of the main functions of the department, ensuring that both state and federal requirements are followed. The proposed bill ties the department's hands in terms of executing its authority in offering clarification and providing guidance to the field. According to the Constitution, the governor must take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The powers of the executive are carried out by the executive agencies. And although this bill does not prohibit the commissioner from issuing pronouncements, the disclaimer that would be required under this bill effectively strips away the department's authority to interpret and enforce the law. And as we all know, no matter how well written a law may be, there are unanticipated situations where it's unclear how exactly the law should be applied. By forcing the commissioner to preemptively determine whether an enforcement of the departmental guidelines is tantamount to a duly adopted rule by requiring a disclaimer, this legislation intrudes on the functioning of the executive branch. The Administrative Procedures Act states the process by which such a decision is to be made. The Office of Administrative Hearings was established to provide a fair, prompt, and impartial hearing process for citizens who disagree with actions taken by the government. One of the three main areas of the OAH authority is to hear and decide cases regarding AAH state agency contested cases and rulemaking hearings. The proposed bill violates the doctrine of separation of powers by stripping power from the executive by rendering MDE pronouncements unenforceable. As you heard before, there have been complaints that the department acts in solely a monitoring and compliance role when it comes to certain aspects of the law. And we do acknowledge that in previous years that there has been certain treatments like that. However, under the current administration, we are trying to move away from a strictly compliance and monitoring role to more of a partnership and more of a support role. The department exercises its authority to issue pronouncements under the law cautiously. This is evidenced by the very few pronouncements that are issued. Such pronouncements are a proper use of executive authority and serve to prevent litigation by preventing disputes from escalating. You heard Mr. Lundell mention that it is our responsibility to come back to the legislature when we see if there's something vague in law and there's a problem with interpretation. And we do that. In fact, the next bill you'll hear is full of examples of those types of situations. But in the meantime, enforcement decisions need to be made, and very much thought goes into each case and each decision. This bill would strip all that away and make all that thought and care moot. So again, I just reiterate that the department does not support this bill, and I would stand for any questions that the committee might have.
Senator Bonhoff.
Madam Chair, did you want to? I just, Mr. Corda, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but the question was, I asked Dr. Peterson why that one particular change happened with the intermediates. Do you have any knowledge, or is there anyone here who has any knowledge about that change and why that might have happened?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I was not involved in making that decision, so I would not have direct information about that with you, but I'd be happy to put you in touch with somebody at the department.
Thank you.
Who would know more about that decision action.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Nenow, did you have your hand up?
Senator Thompson. Oh, Senator Thompson, sorry.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd just like to respond with a couple of points. The issue of separation of powers was brought up. Well, in fact, the Department of Education exists at the pleasure of the legislature, as do all the departments, right? They're created by the legislature in conjunction with the executive branch and put in place to carry out the laws. So in fact, it's almost impossible for the legislature in the context of law enforcement to violate separation of power insofar as it pertains to regulatory agencies, because they serve at our pleasure. However, the reverse is easily accomplished, where the executive goes beyond its scope in interpreting laws and, in fact, ends up making laws that is a direct encroachment on separation of powers in the purview of the legislature pursuant to Article 2. So that argument works exactly in reverse. And there, again, this idea that they'd have to go through some process to make these pronouncements applicable and enforceable by law. Yep, that's exactly what's supposed to happen in our system. So those are the points that I wanted to make in response to the department's testimony.
Thank you. Senator Harrington, you have a furrowed brow. Do you have a question?
Madam Chair, yes, I'm trying to reconcile the concept of separation of powers. Once the legislature has created the agency and has sent it forth and made it part of the executive branch, how that is a violation of the separation of powers when it is following the mandate that it was originally created for, and the need for expedient making of rules and regulations to carry out its mission, given that we are a part-time legislative operation, it does not strike me as feasible that the legislature can provide the day-to-day oversight and direction that a state agency that operates 365 would need. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. I could have some problems with this.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Senator Harrington, two questions, I believe, in that. One is how could they encroach upon us once we created them and put them in a place? The second question was, as a practical matter, we don't meet in August, we hope. And with respect to part one, the best way to describe it, I'll credit Mr. Lundell for this when we were having a conversation preparing. The legislature dictates the what, and the agencies implement the how. And what is being said by the two gentlemen that testified earlier is, in some instances, the department is going beyond the how into the what, into the creation of policy, which, even though they do exist, you're exactly right, they have authority pursuant to statute, they still can't get into creating policy. They're supposed to implement policy as stated by us. Now, to your second question, of how do you deal with it when we're a part-time legislature, that's why we have the rulemaking process. The rulemaking process is in place to be taken advantage of at any time, all the time. And so if the department has a policy that they feel ought to be implemented universally as a matter of interpretation of a statute, they can then get that approved through the rulemaking authority, but it should not be a unilateral decision of the department.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lundell Mr. Corti?
I just wanted to clarify that the department cannot just unilaterally create rules, that we require legislative authority to enter into rulemaking. I just wanted to.
That's correct.
Madam Chair, Senator Harrington, to add to that, I mean, this Senator Cordy, Mr. Cordy is right that the rules gets to be a little bit different story. But there used to be, and I'll date myself here. I don't know how many legislators remember this, but there used to be a legislative commission called the Legislative Commission to Review Administrative Rules. And when agencies got rulemaking authority, oftentimes they would have to come back to this legislative commission where the rules would be reviewed. And unfortunately, that is now a kind of a moribund institution. I think it sits someplace within the Legislative Coordinating Commission, but I'm not certain on that. But I believe that with legislative commissions and other ways, when the legislature is not in a session, there would be some oversight that you could create. Obviously, you can't meet when you're not. You can't do anything with the force of law when you're not in session, but I do believe that there are times, or there may be an opportunity to create a body that could do some of these things and work with the departments as those questions come forward.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions that I have is that when you look at line 1.16, the items that are mentioned in the legislation are policy, guideline, bulletin, criteria, manual, standard, or similar pronouncement to school districts. It seems that not all of them rise to the level of rulemaking. I think if the department were to, let's say, deal with a bulletin or some kind of a guideline, that doesn't really seem to me to rise to the level of a rule, which in turn becomes a law. So is there some way that maybe we could separate those out? I think if the department is going to proclaim or try to enact rules dealing with something that's significant to school districts, obviously I think they need to go through the procedure in Chapter 14. But if a department is going to, let's say, send out or issue guidelines for whatever, that to me doesn't seem like it is of the same significance to all districts. I mean, the same significance as a rule.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Stump, I agree. And those kinds of things should not be treated as though they have the force of law. And that is exactly what this bill is intending to clarify, is those kinds of things do not have the force of law. If a bulletin or a guideline is sent out, we want to make sure that it is clear that those things do not have the force of law, and that's exactly why this legislation exists. And if, in fact, they don't rise to the level that it is worth the time of the department to take it through the process to have it approved in the administrative process, then it shouldn't be presented as something that's enforceable.
Well, Madam Chair and members, it seems like the conflict is between what the department or what districts are perceiving to be a rule versus a guideline or a bulletin or something.
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, members, I think that's exactly what is the problem with this bill, is that it's unclear what a policy, what a guideline, what a bulletin is. These words have different meanings for different people. And I think that obviously there's times where we send out, best practices or dear colleague letters where it's suggesting, a way to behave in a certain situation if a certain issue comes up. But those are not being enforced by the department. What we're talking about when we talk about enforcement is when a parent makes a complaint about action that a school district takes, and that they're violated, that the district is violating state law. And this bill, if you would require us to put in a disclaimer when we send out our compliance messaging saying, okay, you're violating state law, here's what you need to do to get back in compliance, if we're required to say, well, that's not unenforceable, then we don't have the ability to enforce law anymore.
Senator Torres, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I as I think about kind of the purpose of this legislation, this proposal, this bill, I think about, you know, what is the purpose of it other than diminishing really the authority? When you have a document that goes to a school district and say, oh, by the way, you don't have to do this really because we cannot enforce it. Do you think that the districts are going to take anything seriously from the department? And I don't know if that's the intent, Senator, because, you know, having a note explicitly saying, you know, this is not enforceable, you really don't have to do it, it kind of gives a message of, you know, you know, we don't have the power to do anything about this, by the way. This is just a paper, and if you want to follow it, fine. If not, there is no recourse in here. So what is the intent here? I don't understand, Senator.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I would say that actually the intent is, I wouldn't use the term diminish power, but to restrict power to its proper scope. We have a system that's very complex. That's why we're all here taking testimony. Bills get heard on the floor. Administrative agencies get created. Rules are promulgated. There's public testimony because we in this nation value very highly that if something is going to be enforced as a law or a legal rule, that has gone through the proper process. So I actually would want to restrict any government agency from being able to attempt to enforce something that hasn't gone through the proper processes to become law. Yeah, I would be in favor of that.
Thank Senator you. Bonoff.
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, I think that there is an issue, or the legislature led by Democrats wouldn't have proposed it 4 years ago. And I think as legislators, it's our job and our nature to protect the power of the legislature. And as the administration, it's the administration's power and nature to protect the power of the administrative branch. And so I'm concerned that there really is an issue evidenced by, you know, two people we have great respect for, Dr. Peterson, Brad Lundell, bring this concern to us. And yet I think the way that it's written, it's, you know, of course the governor would veto it. I mean, because it in essence does what Patrice, I mean, I think it would. So I'm wondering if there isn't a way, using kind of where Senator Sumpf was going, that we can't work with this language so that it's clear that we actually don't want the department to enforce rules that aren't consistent with our laws. I mean, we don't want that to happen.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, thank you. Certainly that is our intent. I've not yet spoken with the administration about this. I don't presume that the governor would veto it. And
really?
I've not talked to him, and I don't know. And I would hope that, even though you're right, part of what we do as a legislature is to attempt to protect the power that has been granted to us by the Minnesota Constitution, and Governor Dayton would correctly use the power vested in him to protect the purview, those things that are within the purview of the executive branch. I would also hope that all of us would have the deepest respect for the fact that, though I'm a legislator, I don't want to encroach upon the governor's power, because that is the system that we have set up and that we all believe in. So I'm hoping that the governor would be very open to the notion that he doesn't want his agencies going beyond the scope of their authority, just like I, as a legislature, I don't want to see the legislature encroach in the area that is legitimately under the purview of the executive. So I guess I would respectfully disagree that I'm just here to defend the legislature's perspective. I'm here to defend the constitutional system that is at the heart and soul of our republic.
Mr. Lundell, did you have a comment on that?
Madam Chair, no.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up.
Senator Bonnell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, though, I mean, there is, I guess, one other piece is when the department is acting, like sending a bulletin or creating a policy that, in their opinion, allows them to implement a law. I mean, isn't that where the line gets fuzzy?
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonnell, to me, you know, and maybe I'm not able to see all the nuance, but to me, this is fairly simple. It says the department is free to send letters, bulletins, thank you notes, cards, whether by Hallmark or not, that can make any suggestions or promulgate any notions that they want. However, they cannot state or imply that those things have the force of law if they do not. And we have a system they must go through in order for those things to have force of law, and to me, that's entirely reasonable.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Members, we'll take more comments should there be some, but I just want to remind members and testifiers, we do need to be quick. We have the agency bill coming up next, and we have to vacate this room at 4:30.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump. Yeah,
maybe there's a thank you, Madam Chair, a way to tie back to Chapter 14.03, Subdivision 3, which lays out the definition of a rule, and it says a rule does not include, and then it lists a number of different items there, so that if a guideline relating to whatever is in that category, it basically then is not a rule. So I'm thinking that, and I don't have an amendment, but I'm thinking that's the approach that I think could be helpful to both districts and to the department, so that what we do is try to be a little clearer on what actually is a rule and what actually is not a rule.
Mr. Lundeen.
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, I think that, and Mr. Cordy said it, that there could be some redundancy here, but the problem is the department doesn't stop. I mean, we can say, no, these aren't rules, but they keep doing it. Now, that might change. We've got some administrative change. There's been some great things happening between the field and the department in the last year. And we don't want to stunt that progress. They're doing a much better job in their training, and the monitoring is going better. But the clarity still remains that these bulletins and complaint decisions and the like have the force of law once they are issued. And that's the problem. And that's what Senator Thompson is trying to clear up. We want to have a dialogue with the department. We don't want to have a fight with the department. We want to have a dialogue, but we want to make sure that everybody's on the same page, that when the legislature passes a law, the department implements a law, that there's a feedback loop that is making certain that we're not having things come out of the woodwork. And I think that's, you know, I'm trying to think of a more graceful way to say it, but that's really what we're trying to do here, is to say these things have the force of law when they make these decisions. And we don't think that's appropriate.
Okay. Members, we will be voting at 4:15, so are there any other comments from members?
With that,
Senator Thompson?
Pardon me, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, with that, I would move that Senate File 2183 pass, and I think it goes straight to the floor. I'm unaware of any fiscal notes. It will be passed and sent to the floor.
Senator Thompson moves Senate File 2183 pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Bill passes.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to see you. Take care.
Okay.
Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 2228 is the department's agency omnibus policy technical bill. In the interest of time, I'm going to forego my introductory remarks and offer the A2 amendment. And it's first impression right now. So,
Senator Wieger offers the A2 amendment to the amendment. Did you want to discuss the amendment?
Madam Chair, I'd like to include that in the presentation of the bill. It puts it in conformance with the department and some.
Okay. All those in favor of amending Senate File 2183 with the A2 amendment to get it in the shape that Senator Wieger prefers, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment adopted.
Okay, Madam Chair, there's approximately 30 proposals in here, and I'll ask Mr. McHenry to lead off.
Mr. McHenry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. Just want to say, first off, just apologize. Commissioner Caselius was intending to be here for this bill, but she did have a family engagement as this committee went a little long. So sending her condolences for being here. Just want to thank you all for taking the time to listen to this.
Senator Tomasoni, radioactive. Come on in. It's a Geiger counter.
Full of energy. And with that, just in the interest of time,
Mr.
I think
McHenry.
What we'll do is we'll have Mr. Cordy do a quick walkthrough here to kind of go through the provisions.
Mr. Cordy.
And then we also, if...
Oh, go ahead, Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, I apologize. And then if we do have individuals from the department on specific areas, if you all are interested in getting into some further details on any of the specifics.
And as we proceed, members, we do have to vacate at 4:30. If we don't finish today, we're looking at coming back later tonight. Unfortunately, we're checking on a room for that. So I'll let you know. Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, members, starting in Article 1, Sections 1 and 12, 13, clarify education, residency, and transportation for students experiencing homelessness. This aligns districts' responsibility and revenue streams with current reporting practices and allows early childhood special education students to be included as homeless. You'll see in the A2 amendment there was some changes that were made to that language in order to address some concerns that the St. Paul School District had. And we believe that the language change does address those concerns. Sections 2 through 5 and Section 11 are cleanup on last year's homeschool mandate reduction legislation. This ensures that unaccredited non-public schools have the same reporting requirements as homeschools. Also, we initially had the homeschool definition expanded in that bill, but however, at the request of the homeschool advocates and the non-public folks, we did take that out. Moving on to sections 6 through 10, sections 14 through 16, this moves the alternative teacher compensation program away from a general education revenue item to a separate categorical line item.
Mr. Cordy, what's the purpose of that?
Madam Chair, members, the reason that was done is that it's a program that does not go to all districts. It's still kind of in its beginning stages, and we thought it was more appropriate to be under the Education Excellence article in the spreadsheet. So it's aligned in that area. It doesn't touch any of the funds. It still allows all districts to continue doing the exact same thing. It doesn't do anything at all with the funds. It just moves it to a different
area. Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Mr. Cordy, continue.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Section 17 of Article 1 replaces the usage of limited English proficient LEP and English language learner, ELL, in Minnesota statutes and rules with English learner, or EL, to be consistent with USDOE blueprint for ESEA reauthorization. Moving on to Article 2, Section 1 would require the commissioner select districts to participate in standalone field testing, and it implements an appeals process to the commissioner. And Section 1 also would extend the GRAPH math grad alternative pathway passed in 2009 to students that were in eighth grade before 2005-2006. Those students were, there's about 250 to 300 students that are were eligible to take the BST, did not pass the BST, and are not eligible to take or access the math grad pathway that is in law. So this would allow them to access that. Section 2 allows the department to pay post-secondary institution mileage reimbursements for PSEO or alternative students. And it allows students to seek reimbursement directly from the post-secondary institution. Currently, students seek reimbursement from the district. The district has to verify enrollment before getting reimbursed. This just makes it easier for the post-secondary. They validate enrollment, and the student gets their money from the post-secondary. Sections 3 and 5 require authorizers to use student achievement as the number one factor in granting, renewing, or revoking a charter. This would require MDE oversight to ensure that authorizers are using academic achievement as the most important factor. This is necessary to continue to qualify for federal CSP grants, of which we just were rewarded $26 million last week. Section 4 requires charter schools to make school board meeting minutes available and board member contacts info readily available via the school's website. This just aligns charter schools with same requirements that ISDs have. Section 6 is a technical fix, changing days to hours to reflect minimum hours of student instruction required by 120A41. Section 7 and 8 remove the requirement that charter schools submit changes to insurance policies to MDE. It's currently the role of the authorizer to verify that coverage, and the type of coverage is already included in the charter contract submitted to MDE. Section 9 makes typographical changes to organizations listed under the Career and Tech Organization statute consistent with legislative intent. We did receive permission from the chairs to act according to these changes. And then Article 3. Repeals Section 1 and Section 4, 125A.16, repeals the statute relating to temporary placement in a state institution. This is done because all the state institutions are now closed. Section 2 and 4, Section 4, 125A.80, require that resident districts use the MDE tuition billing system to bill non-resident tuition of districts and of students in care and treatment programs who do not have an IEP. This ensures consistency with the billing process for all students regardless of IEP status and removes the requirements that copies of these forms be filed with the commissioner since the billing will already be on file through the tuition system. And then Section 3 clarifies that the district only needs to seek commissioner approval for on-site, that is physically on the grounds of the facilities, education programs for children and residential facilities licensed by DHS or the Department of Corrections. And that completes the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. Members, we have room 318 at 6:30 this evening if we need to reconvene. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to offer at this time the A1 amendment. I don't know that that has been handed out yet to members. Do we have that? I don't believe so. It is. All right. Madam Chair and members, I'm
Senator Thompson.
Thank you. I'm offering the A1 amendment. Chair Olson has indicated that she would like us to like me to introduce this amendment and adopt it, in that these provisions will most likely need to be taken care of in order to get the support that is needed in the committee. And so I think, since it's kind of a line-by-line description, if Ms. Butler could go through what the amendment does once the members of are all taken care of there. Ms. Butler.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, just an, one point. The amendment, the A1 amendment will need an amendment because the A2 amendment actually took care of one line. So, Madam Chair and members, you could actually delete page 1, line 2, that deletes section 2, because that was actually done in the A2 amendment. But then to go on and explain the rest of the A1 amendment, line 1.3, which deletes section 4 on page 3, that's deleting changes to the homeschool and non-public school reporting. That also description also applies to section 5. Then on 1.4, section 6, then also section 7, 8, 9, and 10, takes out the changes that puts the alternative teacher compensation program out of the general education program. Then section 11, which is at line, deletion of, is at line 1.7 in the amendment. Again, deletes a homeschool definition change where it relates to the public school fee law. Excuse me, and then Madam Chair and members, starting at 1.8 of the amendment, deleting sections 14, 15, as well as the deletion of on 1.9 and 1.10. That also is related to removing the alternative teacher compensation program out of the general education revenue program. Then, Madam Chair and members, 1.11 of the amendment, deleting section 1, deletes the section that requires the schools to participate in the standalone field testing, as well as the alternative pathway for passing the math grad requirement. Then 1.12, that's deleting section 3, deletes the section that changes the purpose our purposes for charter schools from a to a primary purpose and additional purposes, and as well as that is also the case, or those changes also relate to the deletion at 1.13 that deletes section 5.
Thank you, Ms. Baxter. I would like to add an oral amendment, Senator Thompson, which would be to strike line 1.2.
Madam Chair, I consider that a friendly amendment.
Thank you. Is there any more discussion on the A1 amendment? Senator Torres-Ray.
Senator Thompson, I think you deleted 90% of this bill. What would be the purpose of
Senator
negotiating?
Torres-Ray, excuse me. I failed. We need to back up just a moment, and we'll get right back to you. Actually, we need to vote on the friendly amendment, the amendment to the A1 amendment.
All right. Thank you, Madam
according
Chair.
To, as Ms. Baxter said. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Amendment to the amendment is adopted. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out that we have deleted kind of major provisions on this bill, and I think the statement of the author of the amendment was that this is a precondition to accepting this. So am I wrong? And I don't know what is left of the bill if we delete all of these provisions.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Cordy.
If I could just go through, since kind of the way that I went through it, maybe this will let you know what is being taken out. The first things that are being taken out is the cleanup on last year's homeschool mandate reduction legislation. I do understand that Senator Olson had some concerns about this, and we definitely respect Senator Olson's knowledge when it comes to homeschools. We did, as I mentioned, discuss with the homeschool community and made some changes to address those concerns that were made in the A2. So we'd like to think that they would be okay with this language, but allow them to speak. And it also would remove the rollout of the alternative teacher compensation. The two biggest concerns that we would have with this bill is the deleting Section 1 of Article 2, which extends that math alternative grad pathway to these 300 or so students. I mean, if you require them to pass the math grad and not give them access to the pathway like every other student has, you're basically dooming them to not get a diploma. These are students who are overage and undercredited, and I'm not sure if there's anybody from the adult basic education community here, but I know that they've been strongly advocating this change. And then also removing sections 3 and 5 of Article 2, I think, would put our charter schools in jeopardy of qualifying for federal funds if we didn't require this, and particularly the $26 million we received last week.
Any further comments?
So, Madam Chair.
So, Senator Bono. Senator Tomasoni.
So some of these deletions you're okay with, but the other ones you're not. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni. You know, obviously, this is the bill that we introduced that we feel is a really good bill. We do want to respect the will of the committee and the will of the chair. We would like to see this bill move forward. There are some, I think what Mr. Cordy just outlined are some issues that we think are resolved, that we think are things that we should move forward with in the bill in the, at this point.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. We're approaching the Senator Wieger, do you have a comment first?
Well, Madam Chair, we will take what we can get at this point.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Well, members, we have two options before us. If you're ready to vote on the bill, on the A1 amendment,
well,
we can.
Chair,
otherwise, we will lay the bill on the table and we'll recess and reconvene at 6:30 tonight. Senator Wieger.
Is the intent for the committee to ultimately have an omnibus bill?
No, there's no intent for an omnibus bill. This would go right to the floor, I believe.
Okay. Well,
Senator Wieger.
If there's not, you know, there's been several other policy initiatives, and I thought we had laid some things over for possible inclusion in earlier motions. But in any event, if this is going to travel on its own, if it can at least have wings, I'll vote against the amendment, but it'll ultimately pass. And to serve notice, I'll have at least a couple of amendments, but we'll work with the majority with an attempt to reach compromise on at least a couple of these items.
Senator Wieger, would you prefer to do that now, or do you feel we need to come back and discuss this further tonight as a committee?
Madam Chair, I'm going to I have two different bonding committee and another. I would just soon see it pass tonight or right now. And we have time in the process, even though this would.
Yes, we will have time.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Because we have a couple minutes. I appreciate Senator Wieger is just looking pragmatically that there are certainly the votes and the majority to move the bill this way. And so given Senator Olson isn't here right now, I suspect that Senator Wieger and the department and Senator Olson could talk about things between the time that it gets out of here. I mean, people can vote how they want to vote, but I'm saying I wouldn't assume that Senator Olson isn't perhaps open to talking about some of the things.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff. I think we'll let Senator Olson speak for herself.
Yes.
Members, Senator Tomasoni.
I would like to get this done right now. And what I would like to do is amend the amendment with whatever you just said, okay, to delete those deletions.
And Madam Chair.
So he can repeat the lines that he doesn't like.
Senator, Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, members, the two articles, or the three sections that we think are most important to keep in this bill in the spirit of compromise would be under Article 2, Section 1, and Article 2, Sections 3 and 5. Again.
Well, here, take this thing and delete out of it what you don't want.
If I could ask.
Mr. Cordy, I think Anne-Marie can do that.
Yep. Madam Chair, members, I believe what he'd like to strike from the A1 amendment would be line 1.11, 1.12, and 1.13. So that would give you, take out the deletions of Article 2, Sections 1, 3, and 5.
Could you repeat that one more time?
Madam Chair, just looking at the A1 amendment, it would be 1.11, 1.12, and 1.13 that you would strike from the A1 amendment.
Members, is there any discussion?
Senator Thompson? I would say that since what we're attempting to do is get a bill out of this committee that can then be discussed and try to get it into a form that's agreeable to everybody, we want to pass. I would prefer that we pass it out of here as the chair would like with provisions that she thinks would be acceptable, and therefore I would request members vote against Senator Tomasoni's amendment to the amendment.
Members, I concur with that, but would ask that I'm sure these particular items will be addressed as we all confer with Senator Olson. All right. Any more discussion on the A1 amendment? On the Tomasoni amendment to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Tomasoni amendment to the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
No. Amendment is not adopted. We have before us the A1 amendment as amended with the Nelson amendment. Any more discussion, members? All those in favor of the A1 amendment as amended And that is with the deletion of line 1.2. You might remember we did that a while ago. Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
The A1 amendment as amended is adopted. Now let's go to
I
the
renew
bill.
My motion that
Senator
Senate
Wieger.
File 2228 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Senator Wieger, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
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 Bill passes and is sent to the floor. Thank you, Senator Wieger. Members, we do not need to reconvene. Meeting is adjourned.